You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 19th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
Jay Novella.
Hey, guys.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks.
So, guys, we had the hottest temperature ever recorded on Earth recently in Death Valley.
Outside of a lab, right?
Yeah. I
mean, oh, right. You know. Outside of a lab, for sure.
Well, I'm assuming.
And probably not the hottest temperature, just, you know, in modern recording, like with good record keeping.
Yeah, it's the hottest temperature recorded.
What does it mean to us?
Well, that's the question. So it was 130 degrees in Death Valley.
Yeah,
130 Fahrenheit, which is what, 54
point something,
yeah. Celsius. Yeah, 54.4 Celsius. There, you know, there's a couple other temperatures that were higher in the past, but they were not really verified, and there are reasons to call them into doubt. So this is the highest non-controversial temperature recorded on the Earth. So, you know, the question is this just the fluctuation in the temperature, or is this going to be a more common event now because of global warming?
Well, and right? Also to be clear, too, it was in Death Valley, which is named that for a reason.
Yeah.
And it was in a specific part of Death Valley called, do you guys remember what it was called? Like the Devil's Furnace or something crazy?
Yeah.
That's like known to be one of the hottest places on Earth. But yes,
yeah,
the hottest place on Earth being as hot as it's ever been.
Yeah, it's just another, it's another, you know, temperature that seems to mean something, right? Like, okay, if that's the hottest and all these other places on Earth are having the hottest temperatures, I mean, it seems like the Earth is warming, right? How else would you judge it?
And are you nervous about the Firenados? Have you seen these?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those are cool. God.
They're amazing. And horrible. Because, you know, wildfire season is like in full gear in California. So we've got Death Valley, hottest temperature on record, wildfires that also have tornadoes ripping through them.
Wind and fire, like, forget it. Like, forget talk it. About deadly combination.
Wind, fire, and coronavirus. Hello, 2020.
I mean, you would just think, like, the fire tornado is the sign of end times.
I know. Yeah, it's like, it might as well just be full of locusts.
Yeah, like, I'm looking at a picture of it right here, and it looks like it's ripping through reality. I mean, oh my God.
Yeah, it almost looks like a special effect out of a movie rather than something naturally occurring.
Right. Especially because in a lot of the images, the sky behind it is so blue because it's not a weather phenomenon. It's in the smoke cloud.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a weather phenomenon, but, you know, it doesn't look overcast. It's like a pretty day and it's just in the cloud from the smoke.
All right. Well, I mean, you know, is this something we're going to have to get used to? Is this another
normal? So 2020 is on track to be the second hottest year on record behind 2016. Of course, you know, if the fall is hotter. Still, it could take the number one spot, but it's going to be in the top five, no doubt.
Yeah, it's an excessive heat warning, like all across Southern California right now. Over 100 where I live, and you know, I'm in Scotland right now, and it's nice and cold. But the person who's house sitting for me is like, "Hey, I think your dog's not doing well in this heat." Like,
oh, killer!
Yeah, it's bad there.
Heat's going to be a huge problem. We're going to see whole populations migrating away from areas that are just too hot to live. You know, like some areas, some of the hottest areas, they may have a few days a year where it's like it's so hot that it's people start dying from the heat. But in the you know, not too distant future, we're going to have many more days a year. So many days, in fact, that you were going to see these populations migrating to areas that aren't going to kill them from the heat. And that's
climate refugees,
big stuff. Yeah.
It's a problem. And
real
like
problem.
People don't have the infrastructure as it changes so quickly. So in places where you never needed an air conditioner before and you could get away with fans or just opening your windows, if people can't afford to retrofit their houses or to put window units in, I mean, a lot of people in LA don't have air conditioners, and I hear horror stories about them during these heat waves having to just like go shopping in the mall or go to the movies or back before the pandemic.
The movies.
Yeah, but like
I remember them.
Would literally spend time away from home because it was unhealthy to be in their houses.
Yeah, England, you don't find much air conditioning in England, from what I understand.
Nobody.
And they've had some real nasty summers recently that they've had to contend with not the level of or ubiquitousness of air conditioning that we enjoy here in the United States. That's for sure.
Yeah. Usually it's just radiators that I see in houses and maybe ceiling fans. Do you guys on the East Coast have radiators or do you have central heat?
They're called radiators.
Radiators are kind of old. They're kind of old tech. You see them in older houses.
That's what I thought. Yeah. In the UK, it's every house has rads.
Yeah.
It's not common at all to have central, like forced air.
You see them
anywhere.
In row houses in Baltimore and things like that. You know, you're not going to see them in a house built in the last 20 years.
Or like, pre-war New York houses and stuff.
Yeah.
Correct.
So let's do the COVID numbers really quickly. Worldwide, 22 million plus cases, 787,000 deaths. In the U.S., which continues to lead the world in coronavirus cases, we're approaching 170,000 deaths and 5.4 million cases. We're starting to get past this second hump now, though. If you look at the weekly trend, it is starting to go down. Still at a high level, though. You know, it's still like at a higher level than the first wave. You know, it's still higher now than it was in April and May, but it's starting to trend down. But, you know, we're all holding our breath now for school. That's going to be the big question because school's starting in a couple weeks.
Here it comes.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and there's no universal plan. It's just like every school system's kind of doing their own thing. And they're making efforts. They're doing half time and requiring masks and trying to social distance. But a lot of it's going to depend on the resources that the school system has and also just the governing philosophy of the region. And so, you know, it's hard to imagine we're not going to see some kind of bounce back when school starts, but we'll see.
Oh, yeah. And as it starts.
It's already happening. We're already seeing COVID spikes from kids going back to school. I predict, I'm not trying to be a jerk here and also be like a podcast doom scroller. You know, I'm just saying, like, I'm following the news. I'm looking at what's happening. And I'm predicting that when the masses get back to school in the United States, which is basically like roughly the last week of August, first week of September, we're going to be closing all of those schools down probably within 1 to 2 weeks, and we're going to have a massive spike in the country.
You're seeing that in places like UNC, Chapel Hill.
Georgia had a problem.
You're having these problems where people go, they catch it, and then they have to go back home, so they're bringing it back to their parents. I think I retweeted the most American tweet ever to it was 2 days ago on Twitter. Yeah, I hashtagged it Murica. By somebody who wrote, just heard from a teacher friend prepping for the school year. They've been told they can't leave classroom doors open to promote better air circulation because that would circumvent the school's automatic locking system that's in place for active shooter situations.
Oh, great.
Take your pick. Yep. COVID or an active shooter.
Right.
Statistically, I would pick COVID. I would defend against COVID.
But I mean, did you guys come across these interesting write-ups of 1918? And again, COVID is not the flu, and I'm not making like a comparison to the disease itself, but to kind of the public health measures that are made about really poor inner city areas back then when people were living in tenements where some cities, I think it was New York City, New Haven and like Boston or maybe Chicago intentionally kept schools open when most places around the country closed schools because they thought kids would actually be safer in schools than in the tenements at home.
Oh, that maybe right? that yeah,
could be
yeah,
true.
Because they had access to nursing care. It was a hygienic place to go to school. They got a meal. And actually the truancy rate was so high because of the pandemic. Nobody was going anyway that they had really good social distancing in place. But of course, there's pushback against that, too, because we're living in a different era. And they're still going home every night and potentially bringing the virus home.
Yeah. Well, we're going to start the news items. Actually, I'm going to be doing the first one, which is a COVID-related news item, the only one this week. But I had to talk about this. I wrote about it on Science-Based Medicine. You guys hear about Oleandra?
Yeah.
I did hear about
some new singer.
Oleandra.
It's the latest COVID snake oil.
Oleandra? Like the flower? Like an oleander flower?
Yeah. Oh.
That's what I thought, too.
Those are toxic, right?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they're super poisonous. Oh, yeah.
Only one consumed.
Movie about it.
Jay, do you played Red Dead Redemption 2, right, Jay?
Of course, yeah. It's one of the plants you can collect.
Yeah, you could collect it. You could make poison out of it.
Okay. That's what the movie White Oleander is about. Do you guys ever see that with Michelle Pfeiffer?
I have, yeah.
Yeah, anyway.
Yeah, so Oleandra is the plant. Oleandrin is the toxin, the botanical extract that you get from it. And it's a landscaping ornamental plant. Very pretty, actually. but it is poisonous. Every part of the plant is poisonous, and there's many accidental poisonings around the world from eating parts of it. It has a cardiac toxin, which causes arrhythmias. So,
hydroxychloroquine.
Yeah, but worse. Much more toxic, actually. Yeah. All right, so here's the thing. So a company is promoting it as a treatment for COVID-19. Oleandrin extract, based upon one preclinical trial that's in preprint. It's not even peer-reviewed.
What?
Although they claim to have other data, it is nowhere in evidence. You know, there's nothing published. You know, again, like companies they have in-house data, whatever. Doesn't mean anything. But this is getting even more news because the company is promoting this drug to President Trump through...
Oh, is this the MyPillow guy?
Yeah, this is the MyPillow guy through HUD Secretary. Yeah, through HUD Secretary Ben Carson.
Ugh.
Yeah, so the MyPillow founder and CEO, Mike Lindell, is a big Trump backer. He recently took a financial stake in the company that produces it and then goes through Carson to Trump to sell them on it. And apparently Trump is quoted as saying the FDA should be approving it, right? Like he's going to put pressure on the FDA to approve it.
God, I hope they push back in a major way.
Oh, it's not going to happen. I mean, I would be shocked.
I'd be shocked too, but I'm so scared how many people are.
Thanks for the recommendation. No.
I mean, how absurd is this? Think about this. The president of the United States is going to pick up the phone, have someone, you know, summoned to his chamber, and he's going to go, "Hey,
I hear
that new drug. You know, can we push that through your process, which is put in place to save lives? Can we just skip the last couple of things that we do to really know that this is not going to kill people or all the other horrible things that a drug could do to somebody?" That, to me, is so bankrupt of morals.
Course.
It's pathetic.
It is bankrupt, but it's not. But the sad thing is, it's not ludicrous in the sense, I think it's naive of any of us at this point to go, "Oh, it'll never happen," or it's just going to fall away because, he doesn't have that kind of power. Like, he can say and do things in press conferences. He can put pressure on people through back channels. I mean, he's pushing the boundaries of what a democratically elected president can get away with. And it's like, A, nothing surprises us anymore, and B, he seems to keep getting away with shit. So I'm not saying he's going to bend the FDA to his will necessarily, but for us to be like, "Oh, this is ludicrous and it's never going to go anywhere," I bet I could put money on the fact that people are going to die because of this. And that's sad.
Yeah, but it's not going to be because the FDA is going to give any kind of premature approval.
But it'll be because Trump says something stupid.
Yeah. So here's the thing. Let's put this into historical context, because the reason that I wrote about this and I want to talk about it is not just because, Trump is promoting another snake oil. It's that this is standard operating procedure for the alternative medicine and supplement industries. This is what they do. They find something that is an obscure product that's in and of itself worthless, and then they make up some treatment for it, right? And then they promote it. You know, you corner the market on acai berries, right? Acai berries are worthless. They're crap. They taste horrible. They have no market value whatsoever.
And I'm allergic to them, by the way. They make my skin break out.
You take this tropical berry that has zero market value, and then you make up shit about it. And you promote it as the latest exotic natural herbal supplement treatment, nutraceutical, whatever.
Yeah. Get a little
every
populist
LA
trend going, and there you go. It's off to the races.
But so how do you trend it though? So you could just do the social media thing and hope you get lucky, or what's the holy grail? You get some kind of celebrity endorsement. And what's the biggest
– or government endorsement.
The
president of the United States.
Well, for a time, the biggest celebrity endorser of snake oil was Dr. Oz.
You get
on the Dr. Oz show, and then that's it. You're just printing money at that point. This scenario has been playing itself out for decades, right? This is old.
Mm-hmm.
But the only difference now is that President Trump is in the role of the celebrity endorser. You know, that's the only difference. All right, there's another angle to this that is worth pointing out, because the person who runs the company, Andrew Whitney, he's from Phoenix Biotechnology, the company making oleandrin, basically said, all right, we're going to try to get this either FDA approved as a drug to treat COVID, or failing that, get it approved as a dietary supplement.
Oh, there you go. Thank you. So, Orrin Hatch and Deshaies and all that.
Yeah.
They can do whatever they want then, right? Because it's not FDA under FDA purview.
Well, in the United States, these are the rules. The rules are governed, as Evan said, by Deshaies, the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act of 1994, which basically says that the FDA has no sort of pre-market authority over supplements, and that supplements can make quote-unquote structure function claims without any evidence of safety or efficacy. And basically, right, they're regulated like food, but you can market them like drugs as long as you don't name a disease by name, right? You can't say it cures
cancer.
Yes, and
you have to put that thing, right, that says this
boost your energy levels.
Yeah, you could say it boosts your immune system, and the immune system is important for fighting cancer. And this guy took it, and his cancer went away.
Small print, this will not cure any disease.
But they say, yeah, this was not reviewed by the FDA, whatever.
Yeah, there's a two-line disclaimer that has to go in there.
And half the time, they don't even do that. Half the time, they don't even do that. But that is this massive hole, you know, in the middle of regulation. And it basically creates this artificial thing that doesn't exist of supplements that are really drugs, you know, or drugs that are being marketed
as supplements. Yeah, it's scary if they're toxic, for example.
Yeah. And so here's a perfect example. This guy is basically revealing the scam. He's revealing the scam. He's like, we're going to take this toxic drug that happens to be purified from a plant, but who cares? That's irrelevant. We're going to take this toxic drug, and we're either going to get it approved as a drug, and for failing that, we'll just market it like a dietary supplement, and we'll have to be careful in our wording so we don't say it cures COVID, but we'll implicitly make that claim. You doing all the things that I said.
Brutal.
So again, just revealing the scam right there in this one thing. So what is the evidence? What is the evidence for this? Again, so it's in vitro, meaning, you know, again, in a test tube, basically, not in a living organism. The extract, oleandrin, inhibits the SARS-CoV-2 virus. So the F what? That is so meaningless. It is
so
completely meaningless.
In vitro. Like, I don't want to take bleach.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that you can put enough of it into a test tube that it's going to have a negative effect on anything that is alive or quasi-alive, like a virus, doesn't tell you anything about its potential as a drug, really.
No,
all it
really just tells us that it's a toxin, as we already knew.
Right. Right.
That it kills you or makes you very sick.
In order to know that it could be a useful drug, you need to know that it has a clinically significant beneficial effect at a dose that is non-toxic, right?
Thank you.
And this study doesn't tell us that at all. It also doesn't tell us anything about what we call pharmacokinetics or pharmacodynamics. What does it do to the body? What does the body do to it? How much do you absorb? Where does it go? How does it get metabolized? How does it get excreted? You know, what negative effects does it have on every organ system? How does it interfere with metabolism, et cetera, et cetera? So you need to do years of this kind of preclinical data just to be able to move on to then animal data. And then you need to do enough animal toxicity data and other data in order to then do the first, like, phase 1 human trials, which is just all about safety. And if you pass that hurdle, you can go on to phase 2, which is safety and preliminary efficacy. And if you pass that, then you can go on to phase 3, which is safety and definitive placebo-controlled, you know, double-blind efficacy trials.
Right.
So you're talking about 10 to 20 years.
This drug is barely at the first step. Barely.
It's not even at the first step.
Not even.
It's at the level of, like, when Trump said, what if we just shine a UV light inside of the body?
Yeah.
Like, that's what we're talking about. Like, yeah, of course.
We're talking about one preclinical.
It's going to kill something in a petri dish.
Yeah, one preclinical preprint, not even peer-reviewed study.
And why does this guy under the illusion that the FDA would ever take one study like this
because
and
he's got
give it some kind of approval?
Trump wants it,
too. Yeah, because he's got to back-channel the Trump.
Yeah.
You know, that's why.
But, about the president's ear.
But why would, independent of that, why would the FDA consider this as a candidate?
This is the whole supplement industry. This is it. This is what they do. Based upon this like in-house preliminary preclinical data, they make some kind of a strained claim, right? This is all of curcumin, right? And turmeric, right? This is all of, again, like acai berry or whatever. It's that.
So this guy who's owning this or manufacturing or whatever is just feigning that he'll ever go to the FDA to get some kind of official approval as a drug.
Yeah.
And he's just going to go the dietary supplement route.
Probably.
Did you guys see the MyPillow guy on Anderson Cooper?
Yeah. God, what a sleaze bag.
No, what tell me about that.
Anderson just like would not let him. Yeah, he ripped him a new one. He actually basically said like, you're not a scientist. You have no credentials. You stand to make money off of this. How are you any different from a snake oil salesman? Like he asked him that on air, which
and
I
his response was, it was a Gish Gallop of the typical response.
Oh, great.
Was, I'm saving lives over here. I'm just, you don't want to save lives. I'm just saving people's lives. I'm doing
so
this for the glory
charity.
Of Jesus. Yeah. So I'm just doing what Jesus tells me to do. So he just invoked God and just this.
Oh boy.
This guy is right out of a patent medicine wagon selling snake oil 150 years ago. That's exactly what this guy was.
Step right up.
Yeah, exactly.
You, young lady, you
look modern version of that. Just a modern. He's just a snake oil barker, this guy. But he's got the ear of our president. And that's why it's news. But I think, you know, it does reveal the scam that is the supplement industry in this country and the completely dysfunctional regulatory framework that we have in place. Because, you know, any scientist looking at this knows, like, yeah, the probability that this thing is going to turn into a useful drug based upon what we know at this point in time is minuscule. It's minuscule. Chances are most of the time you have to tweak it chemically. Right? Like drugs have to have a suite of features in order to be useful clinically. And we've already picked all the low hanging fruit, you know, pretty much, you know, in order to bring any kind of molecule over the finish line to a useful drug, a safe and effective drug, it's going to have to be chemically tweaked. There's a whole industry of scientists whose job it is to figure out how to do that. If you're just going to take an extract of a poison, like a known toxic plant, and you think that that's going to translate immediately into a useful drug without any alterations and without doing clinical trials, et cetera, that is, you know, the probability of that is negligible.
That is 18th century thinking
right
there.
It's negligible.
Yeah.
So
insane.
Yeah, it's terrible. All right, let's move on. I think I beat that dead horse. Jay, can we get to the moon in the Dragon capsules? In SpaceX's Dragon capsules?
Well, that is a really interesting question. Something that I thought about independently because I think a lot about space travel. So what do we know? SpaceX has been having a lot of fantastic successes over the past few years. The best thing that they did was the Demo 2 mission that successfully brought two astronauts to the International Space Station and then brought them back home. It was, from my information, pretty much a flawless mission. The design of the command module to the spacesuits, everything was really cool looking, modern, the latest and greatest technology. You know, they had been making technological advancements on the Dragon capsule from the moment they first designed it to the second it was being used. It's just a technological feat. And then, you know, all the other technology that they developed, their launch system, everything. So, but even with all this recent technological advancements, we're still pretty far away from the technology that we need to send people to the moon. I mean, we have it in sight, but we don't have it built yet, all of it. And that's the problem. Now, time, of course, is always a factor, but the real thing here is the U.S. government willing to spend the huge amount of money that's going to take to get us to the point where we have all of these different pieces of technology in place, you know, with the other considerations, of course, because we're safety standards and all sorts of different things that go into this. But it really does boil down to the approval of money. And when the government makes monetary budgets and approves money, they come with stipulations. And, you know, there are stipulations like NASA. Some people in the U.S. government think that NASA should be really in charge of all of the builds, all of the components. So as a cost-saving measure, some people are saying, hey, let's go with a smaller command module because the Orion module that's proposed for the Artemis moon mission, the manned moon mission. It's a big module. It's a big spacecraft. And it has a ton of equipment on board. It's got a ton of safety mechanisms on board. That means it's big and it's heavy. So it's been made clear that the expectation by the U.S. government is that the next lunar mission must use the Orion Command Module, and it must also be launched on the Space Launch System, the SLS system, the launch system that the U.S. government has produced through NASA. Still, some of the technology required is being farmed out to several outside contractors, and this means that a workable balance has been struck between NASA-built versus private-built components. The question is, can we make the deadline? And if we can, what technology do we need to make the deadline? One big concern, like I said, is the weight of the Orion spacecraft. It's just big and heavy, which means more fuel is going to be needed to get it into low Earth orbit. And then, you know, it's got to go all the way to the moon. It's got to do all the maneuvering it needs to do in orbit around the moon, then it's going to come all the way back to Earth. There's a lot of consideration here, and a heavy spacecraft means more fuel, and more fuel means more fuel. You know what I mean? We've talked about this in the past.
Yeah, the fuel equation.
It gets kind of funny, because if you want to put more fuel up, it costs you more fuel to infinity. So we also have to include the human factor here. So the plan is to send four people to the moon. Two of those people are going to go down to the surface of the moon. That means that four people, for example, would have to be in the Dragon capsule, and they'd have to spend at least 3 days getting there. However many days that they'd stay in orbit around the moon, I've heard varying degrees of time. Like, it could be a very long time. It could be weeks that they stay there, and then another 3 days back. That could end up being an enormous amount of time in small, tight quarters. And there's enough room for astronauts to get out of their seats in the Dragon capsule. They can stretch. And they might even be able to maneuver themselves to a place to get a little bit of privacy, not real privacy, but more of like I'm turning my back to everyone privacy. But let's not kid ourselves. It's a small vessel. It wasn't built to take people to the moon. It was built to take people into low Earth orbit, meaning going to the space station or, you know, for the future, some other type of space station that we have. This next part is pretty mind-blowing. So looking at the current NASA expenditures, there's approximately $3.5 billion a year spent on development for the Orion and the Space Launch System that they've been spending so far. Current estimates say that the Orion capsule will not really be able to be fully tested until 2023, which is way too close to the actual mission. If NASA spent the same amount of money on the SpaceX vehicle and their launch system, they could purchase several Crew Dragon modules and several launch system flights. For the same amount, $3.5 billion. So you just, in one hand, you have the Orion capsule, and in the other hand, you have multiple Dragon capsules and basically as many launches as you need to do the mission for the same amount of money. So you think, wow, well, why the hell wouldn't we do that then? So when we look at the cost comparison that was created by the Planetary Society, so far NASA has spent $23.7 billion on developing the Orion spacecraft compared to the $1.7 billion that was invested to develop the Crew Dragon, right? That's what we gave SpaceX to further their technology. So 23.7 versus 1.7. On top of that, the Crew Dragon has been flight tested, right? It's totally proven itself many times. It's done everything that we've asked it to do and more. So comparing the launch vehicle systems now, they've invested $20 billion in the Space Launch System, the SLS. The rocket is over a year away from actually being tested. It's estimated that the rocket will cost, hold on to your seats, $2 billion per launch. My God, I hope that is wrong. I hope that is wrong, Bob. When I read it, I'm like, that can't be right. This information is wrong. I tried to find it in other locations and I couldn't, but $2 billion per launch. What the hell? Compare that to the fact that SpaceX paid for all of the Falcon Heavy rocket development, right? And it would only cost NASA $150 to $200 million per lunar launch. What? That is a massive dollar difference. Look at that. $2 billion versus $150 to $200 million per launch. So now we're, you know, I'm not trying to build the case. I'm just reading you the facts. It seems like SpaceX really, from an economic perspective, is the way to go. The only thing that we don't have is a massive, you know, Dragon capsule that will take people to the moon. So what we can summarize here is that means that the Falcon Heavy rocket is an extraordinarily low cost heavy lift system, which, you know, has never been built before. We don't, no other low cost system has ever existed before the Falcon Heavy. Beyond the money, it seems that the only hope of getting astronauts to the moon by 2024 is the use of SpaceX's technology, which I just said. So with Orion and the SLS launch system still not fully tested, there's no guarantee that they'll be ready and fully tested in time to make the 2024 date. So to answer the question, Steve, it seems like without SpaceX, 2024 is an impossibility. Now, there's one more thing I want to talk about. We also have to face the fact that the Dragon capsule, like I said, wasn't designed to go to the moon. Now, let me tell you some of the differences. It's designed for low Earth orbit. There would need to be modifications made to the capsule. They'd have to do things like change out the navigation systems and other systems that they have. The communication systems would have to be completely done, because in low Earth orbit they were just using satellites to communicate. Well, you can't do that from the moon, right? You need a much more powerful system. So what some people are saying is, once they beef up the Dragon capsule, it's starting to look a lot more like the Orion capsule, right? So it's this weird catch 22 that they're like, well, should we go with SpaceX's equipment? And if we do beef it up, how much heavier will it get? So the Falcon Heavy also is not rated to launch humans into space. So what the experts are saying is that they'd have to launch two Falcon 9 rockets to get all the equipment up there that we need. Still, it's less expensive than using the SLS system. So moving forward, what they're saying is it's going to be, what's the magic word? A hybrid. We need a hybrid model of using some NASA-built modules, and of course, outside components built by SpaceX and other companies. But guys, I'm not seeing the clarity that I would expect at the end of 2020 for this 2024 mission to happen. You know, SpaceX is the only thing that's been fully vetted, tested. If they beef it up, it's going to be heavier, but I suspect that SpaceX is going to be able to still make it lighter than the Orion. And I found out something cool about the Orion capsule that I did not know, and I suspect you guys don't know. Orion started off as a capsule that was going to be sent to an asteroid. Then they changed it to another thing, and then they changed it for another purpose. So this Orion capsule has been changed, you know, multiple times. It wasn't conceived from the beginning as a moon mission capsule. So that is a problem, because it means that it has all sorts of other things that are cooked into it that are either not necessary or overbuilt. Maybe certain areas were underbuilt that they had to beef up. So it doesn't surprise me that it's really heavy and big, and that it would cost a shitload of money to get this thing to where we need it to go. Did I even answer the question, though? I wonder. I don't know. I don't think there really is a clear answer, but it certainly sounds like SpaceX is the front runner here. Now, Steve, are you nervous?
Not really. I think they have a lot of options, which is good. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, being the Orion capsule is designed as a deep space capsule.
Yeah.
That's its purpose. The Dragon capsule is a low Earth orbit capsule, but it can be modified potentially to become a deep space capsule, right?
Yeah, and I was questioning, why wouldn't they make Orion, reusable to the point where it doesn't leave, once it goes to low Earth orbit, it never comes back until it's done, 10 missions or something. You know, make it be, we're ferrying people to the Orion capsule, which is the vehicle that goes back and forth. I highly doubt it's capable of that, but that does seem like a logical way to build spacecraft at this point.
Definitely, I think at some point we need to get to the point where we have ships that do nothing but go from Earth to the moon. They never land again. They're just going back and forth between the Earth and the moon. That makes sense.
The thing is, though, getting the resources. That's why if you can mine the moon, going from the moon to orbit is a lot less expensive than going from the Earth to orbit. So
yeah,
you got to get the resources there. And that's it's going to be expensive. Then, of course, that could lead to a space elevator discussion, but that's beyond our scope.
I know. All right, so SpaceX it is. Thank you. Move on.
All right. Kara, so you're going to tell us about this study. This was a vision experiment, they're saying, that resolves a longstanding, controversy over how our vision works.
Right, and really it comes down to a philosophical question. And that's why I think this is a really interesting study, because it was three scientists who worked on it together, a psychologist, a cognitive scientist, and a philosopher, which is pretty cool. And the philosophical question really comes down to this. When you look at a coin, not head on, so it's rotated in some way, does it look circular to you or does it look elliptical?
I would think elliptical. Elliptical.
But somehow you still know that it's round, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah, you're not questioning.
Like shape constancy or something, what do they call that?
Yeah, so there's something about it that has a roundness vibe. And another example would be like if you're looking at a sewer cover, like what are they called? Like a, I don't want to call it a manhole.
Cover.
A human hole. I don't know what the new
person
word is.
Hole yeah, cover.
As you
but
approach
we know
it.
It's round. Care, mm-hmm. We know it's round like a coin or a manhole because we know what a coin and a manhole's true shape is. If this was something that we had just like a disc that's unidentified in you know any other way, then I think you could confuse yourself into thinking that whether, you know, if it's oval or a circle, depending on how it's rotated. If that information's gone, then yeah, you could say that's an oval, but no, look, I could rotate it, right?
Right. So the question is, how early in your visual processing pathway does that information that you have affect the actual pattern? So what we're talking about here, yeah, is the difference between perception and actual visual data that's written kind of into your retina with light.
It's hard to think of an advantage there would be to saying something's a circle rather than elliptical in shape. You know, I don't see why our brain would necessarily have a necessity to try to make that calculation.
Well, think about it this way. Like, if you were to look at an object or really any visual scene, you need to be able to get a gestalt of the visual scene pretty quickly. And you need to be able to make sense of the patterns that you see. So one of the things that often that they use in the example in the article is that when you look at somebody's face, you don't really notice the shadow that their nose casts on their face unless you're looking for it. It doesn't like affect the way that their face looks to you. You still perceive their face as a face.
Right.
And so the real kind of question comes down to this difference between what they're calling like a distal, how do they word it? So they're talking about perspectival shape, right? So they use that term a lot in the article. And they want to know, is this, you know, something where it's being processed, it's a character of the object itself, or is it something where later on in our kind of brain pathway, we're adding that information? And this experiment doesn't actually look at the pathway itself. It's different than a lot of experiments that we often talk about when it comes to visual perception on the show, where we're looking at like which neurons are lighting up and people are in scanners. In this one, they did, it's a pretty like ingenious experiment. So they really wanted to know, and again, I think that the question of is it this or is it that is sometimes, you know, having that binary is a little bit unfair because it's as if there are only two choices. But they talk about Locke and Hume sort of saying that we perceive the 2D projective and then we just add the 3D understanding of the world to it. So here's the quote. When we set before our eyes a round globe, it is certain that the idea thereby imprinted on our mind is of a flat circle, variously shadowed with several degrees of light and brightness. So they're saying we see a circle and then we see all the shadows. And then later on, we perceive that as a globe. And then you've got...
So you have to get to 2D first before you can get
right,
to 3D?
Exactly. And then you've got the kind of quote opposite view from people like Helmholtz, the famous neurophysiologist or just physiologist in general, and Gibson, who say, no, we primarily perceive 3D properties first, and then we can actually like name or list or appreciate the 2D aspects only through effort. So they said, quote, no one ever saw the world as a flat patchwork of colors. No infant, no cataract patient, not even Bishop Berkeley. The notion of a patchwork of colors comes from the art of painting, not from any unbiased description of visual experience. So they're saying, no, you see a globe, a 3D globe. That's how you perceive it. You don't perceive something flat and then like tell yourself it's 3D. And that's been a big argument. So what these researchers did was really ingenious. They basically, first in a digital representation and then actually in a physical representation where they built little like almost like statues and put them in a box. They had flat circles, so it looked like a coin straight on. They had the elliptical changes, so like when you rotate a coin, they re-represented the exact same geometry so that it's like you're looking at a coin from a rotated perspective. And then they basically just made ellipses. And they asked people, which one's the ellipse? And of course, everybody got it right really quickly. It's pretty easy to pick out an ellipse versus a head-on coin or a rotated coin. But they weren't really interested in the exact answer. They were interested in how long it took them to determine which ones were the ellipse, because those reaction times are comparable to other studies where, let's say I asked you, which one is the letter lowercase b? If you had a Z and an X on either side, you could pick the B easily. But if you had, let's say, an uppercase B and a lowercase D on either side, it would take you longer because the cues are too similar. So the idea here is the longer it takes you to decide, the more the things look similar. And you have to really think about it. It takes effort. If they're really, really obviously different, you're gonna decide quickly. And they found that when they said, which one is the ellipse, if they had to choose between the ellipse and a turned coin, that it actually was a very slow decision to be made. And then they looked at all the different reasons that this could be the case that were not due to the physical property of a rotated coin being elliptical in nature. So they were like, maybe it's reflecting more light. We'll control for that. Maybe it's because things that are on edge are harder to see or perceive. We'll control for that by making them move. So they did 9 different versions of this experiment, one of which they were like, maybe it's a problem with the way that we shade them because these are computer representations, like a graphic design. So they actually cut out wooden coins. And some of them they turned, some of them they put edge on, and then some of them they just cut as ellipses. And they did it like in a naturalistic setting. And in every single experiment, when they said, which one's the ellipse, people chose the ellipse, but they chose it slower when there were turned coins next to the ellipse than when there were shapes that were more face on. So the question here supports
the 2D argument, doesn't it then?
Right. So this supports what you kind of said at the very beginning, right? That there's something about the two-dimensional character, the elliptical nature of a coin that's been turned, that persists, even though we can immediately say that's still a coin. It maintains its coinness, its roundness, even on once it's turned. Even though we know that at a high level, there's something about its ellipticalness that is still interfering with our processing. So what they weren't able to do is say, you know, is this an unconscious process? Is it happening like at the retinal level? Where in the brain is it happening? But what they were able to say is that maybe we shouldn't be so quick to discount the kind of Lockean Humean view, because most modern neuroscientists have actually held more of a Helmholtz view. Maybe we should start looking more at what these researchers call the dual character, that there is an objective shape out there. A coin that's been turned on its side is objectively more elliptical, but there's also a perspectival shape that comes from within us. So because we know it's a coin, because like you said, we have a heuristic and a previous experience of coinage, we could say, no, but it's still got a roundness to it. And that those two things are probably working together in our visual perception.
Cool.
It's a cool experiment. I like it because sometimes I think we look at philosophy and psychology very separately. And so you have philosophers who are working on these like core phenomenology issues or epistemological issues, and then maybe putting their feet in the psychological literature or the cognitive or neuroscience literature. And then you have the hard scientists who are working on these hard problems, and they're maybe dipping a toe in the philosophical debate. But to see those things described in an intermix, like multidisciplinary way, I think is actually really important because they help answer the question at many different levels. And you start to see consensus, which is really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. Especially, you know, of course, my bias is like when the philosophy gets disconnected from the neuroscience, it just goes off,
right.
Spins off into fantasy.
Exactly.
Life, you know?
And so, like, I've always been really interested in modern philosophy, especially, I think, a lot of times vision philosophy, kind of philosophy about perception. These is often anchored in neuroscience and psychology and some of the early experimental, they're so interested in what these findings are. And they're like, how do we make sense of this from a core introspective or like human place? And so I like it when you see those disciplines all working together.
All right. Yep. Thanks, Kara. Bob, what is a black dwarf supernova?
At the end of the universe just got a little bit more interesting, perhaps with this new research suggesting that white dwarf stars could end their lives at the extreme end of the universe with what is being called a black dwarf supernova. If you've read about and kind of think you have a good idea what white dwarf stars are, that term, black dwarf supernova, should be very surprising, a little shocking. This research was recently published in the monthly notices of the Royal Astronomical Society. So yeah, this is pretty dramatic. White stars simply don't have the mass to create the conditions required to go supernova. I mean, it's just not there. And so how can it happen? What kind of scenario is needed to actually make that happen? So to answer that, though, we're gonna have to go over what a normal supernova is. This is the classic supernova I'm talking about, type 2 supernova, or more descriptively, a core collapse supernova. So this happens in stars that are big, 8 to 50 solar masses, really big. Supermassive stars like this, and all stars, of course, go through the periodic table fusing successive elements to create this outflowing energy that they need to fight against the relentless inward pull of gravity. It's a struggle to maintain its equilibrium. And it's something that the star does its entire life. So things go swimmingly for hundreds of millions of years. And then, of course, iron is formed. And this is an absolutely critical milestone. With iron, there's no net energy gain in this scenario from fusing iron and nickel, it turns out. So it just sits there in the core like a lump, not fusing anything. And this inner core, now the inner core does compress as much as it can. But those electrons eventually refuse to be driven closer due to degeneracy pressure, which is such a fascinating concept. I love the different various flavors of degeneracy pressure. Look into it if you're interested. So what happens is that once enough iron is created, though, you know, it keeps building up, and eventually you pass what's called the Chandrasekhar limit of 1.44 solar masses, and the degeneracy pressure says, screw this, and it collapses. Bam, the iron-nickel core collapses. Very, very fast. So when that collapses, the outer core is like a Wile E. Coyote going off the cliff. It's like, whoa, whoa, whoa. For like 2 seconds, he's like, what's going on? Then the outer core collapses to the inner core. And now the inner core collapses, but then it runs up against another degeneracy pressure, neutron degeneracy, and it stops right there. So the outer core bounces off of that, traveling at, I think, a quarter of the speed of light. And that bounce creates that the outward push that just blows apart the rest of the star, and you're left with just the core. And you see the conventional supernova that we see in our telescopes and movies and in our imaginations. So that's a supernova in a big star. Smaller stars, less than that, say 0.5 solar masses and above to maybe close to 8, they never get to iron. They just don't ever make it. They stop after making elements like carbon and oxygen primarily. There may be a little bit of neon and magnesium. And when it's all said and done, you're left with something as big as the Earth with a mass around the sun, a white dwarf. So there was never enough mass to overcome that electron degeneracy pressure, right? Just wasn't enough there. And so the electrons held. It just never collapsed. But you basically have a core that's got carbon and oxygen, and conventional wisdom has been saying for many, many years that it just fusion stops and it just cools down over trillions of years. And eventually, theoretically, after 10 to the 20 years, it chills so thoroughly that it becomes a black dwarf star. And from there, depending on what source you look at, from there, black dwarf star can exist essentially indefinitely. Nothing's going to happen to it unless, of course, there's proton decay. Then that's not good. But if there is no proton decay, then yeah, indefinitely is a word I've seen in a lot of research. It could last a very, very long time, which is, you know, putting it mildly. So here's the new bit. The new bit goes against this idea that fusion has stopped for these dwarf stars. Theoretical physicist Matt Kaplan, assistant professor of physics at Illinois State University, says that there is fusion happening, even if there's no intense heat or pressure that you would think would be required for that to happen. So it accomplishes this, he says, by using quantum tunneling. It just takes a really, really, really times a trillion, long time, really long time. So quantum tunneling is fascinating. It describes a subatomic particle passing through what would seem like an insurmountable barrier. Like, here's a lame example, you're gently bouncing a ball against a wall only to find out that it disappears and reappears on the other side. That's kind of what's happening at the subatomic scale. It has to, if you want to be a little more accurate and technical, it has to do with a tiny piece of the wave function extending beyond the barrier, meaning that there's a very, very small but finite probability that it will appear in that area. But this is real. This tunneling is real, and you wouldn't have your computers or the sun would barely shine without it. Did you know that tunneling is a critical component for making stars shine? When hydrogen atoms, the classic image of, say, proton-proton fusion is that the hydrogen atoms smash together with such force that they fuse, and you end up with a helium atom and some extra energy, and that's star shine right there. That's why stars shine. That's so pretty obviously amazingly simplistic, but what's really happening is that these hydrogen atoms are, for the most part, getting close enough. They're getting very close, but not close enough to fuse. And what happens is they're actually tunneling that last little bit of the way. They're tunneling and fusing because of the tunneling. So I'm not saying that fusion wouldn't happen without tunneling, but it would be tiny. It would be a tiny effect. I'm not sure what the universe would look like, but it would be pretty boring and not very well lit. So tunneling is critical, even just for regular fusion. So the fact that this guy is saying that tunneling is happening with these white dwarf stars in the deep future, hopefully will make a little bit more sense. So this is what they believe will happen. So as a star cools into a black dwarf, heavier elements like the oxygen, neon, and magnesium will migrate to the core, where they will get close enough for tunneling to happen more frequently, right? I mean, tunneling happens more frequently when things are close together. If they're far apart, it could still happen. You could theoretically have one particle tunnel a mile, but the odds of that happening, you would probably need a universe quintillion to the quintillionth power long in order for that to happen. But it theoretically could happen. It's just much less likely. So you've got these elements coming closer into the core of the black dwarf. So he says that over time, they will fuse into iron. And then once you have iron, then what I just described for the core collapse is supposed to happen. It builds up the iron over many, 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 many eons. It builds up the iron, and eventually it could get over the Chandrasekhar limit, and then it could collapse and then cause a supernova at the end of the universe, essentially. So, and remember, when I say over time, I mean over time. I'm going to put some numbers to it. The biggest black dwarf stars, they're going to supernova first, right? Because they're the biggest, they're going to create enough iron in order to go supernova, and it's going to take 10 to the 1100 years. And I have four exclamation points in my notes. 10 to 1100 years. How many years is that? I actually found the number. That's 100.
What?
That's
no
one. Number. Oh yes, I found it. That's 100 trace and quin sexagintillion years. Oh boy. Yeah.
Oh, that's
wait
all.
A minute.
Yes, it's even got sex in the name, which makes it even better. Seriously? So, yes. So, but guys,
bajillion or that's gazillion.
A sexy number.
Yes, that number ends with sexagintillion, and I love it. So, so that's just 10 to, that's just the biggest black dwarfs, guys. What about the small guys? These are small.
Yeah, what
these
about
are
them?
These are white dwarfs that may exist now that are unfortunately not like the sun. The sun's just doesn't have quite enough mass for this to happen, it seems. But stars that are slightly bigger than the sun could eventually go, and they could be, if this theory holds out, this could be the last fireworks of the universe. Their numbers put it at, get this one, 10 to the 32,000 years. 10 to the 32,000 years. It's like, I never thought I'd find a number for that, but I found it. I found a number to describe 10 to the 32,000. Had to do a little, addition here, but it comes, this number is 10 sextillion tre milia tre sendo tri gentillion years. So that's the number. That's how many years we're talking about. I just love that these numbers have been thought about and are actually written down somewhere. So yeah, a lot of years. Now remember, that assumes that proton decay does not occur, because I think if proton decay kicks in, then that's like 10 to the 40 years. So none of this will happen. And it's still a long time, but it'd be cool. It's cool to think that these things could exist that deep into the future. But that's so far into the future, guys. I have never heard of numbers this deep into the heat death of the universe. I mean, black holes will be gone. I mean, black holes won't last much more than 10 to the 100 years. What's 10 to the 100 compared to 10 to 1100 or 10 to 32,000? It's nothing. Entropy is essentially at maximum. I mean, it's just so deep into the future. There's going to be, nothing will, besides these black hole supernovas, I guess not much else will exist besides maybe electrons or some just low grade heat where you can't do any work. It's not going to be fun, but it's just kind of nice to know that deep in the future where there may be these little explosions of coolness that happen right before the very bitter, bitter end.
Cool. Yeah, that's a long time.
Yeah, this is a fun one.
It's almost as long as this new segment.
Hey! But yeah, right. You will cut it to shreds, I'm sure. I already cut it, I already cut it down for you.
Yeah,
I
don't doubt it.
I was going to go off on electron degeneracy pressure, but I said, nope, Steve will definitely cut that out, so I won't put it in.
All right, Evan, so we've heard a lot about the Pentagon UFO videos,
mm-hmm.
but now I understand they're actually starting a task force. Tell us about that.
Absolutely. This happened last week in America, the establishment of the Unidentified Aerial Phenomena Task Force, UAPTF. I'm going to read this directly. It's short. It's just six sentences, so bear with me. I'm going to read the press release so you can hear it from the source, and then we'll talk about why this is an SG news-related item. August 4th, 2020, approved the establishment of an Unidentified Aerial Phenomena Task Force, UAPTF. The Department of the Navy will lead it. The Department of Defense established this task force to improve its understanding of and gain insight into the nature and origins of UAPs. The mission of the task force is to detect, analyze, and catalog UAPs that could potentially pose a threat to U.S. national security. The Department of Defense and the military departments take any incursions by unauthorized aircraft into our training ranges or designated airspace very seriously and examine each report. This includes examinations of incursions that are initially reported as UAP when the observer cannot immediately identify what he or she is observing. That's it. That's the whole statement. So taken at face value to me, this seems pretty innocuous, frankly.
Yeah.
They're saying that their pilots and personnel occasionally will witness things, unfamiliar things sometimes, in flight. And at the same time, they're saying that military instruments might detect things which cannot always be positively identified at the time of detection or even in the analysis afterwards. And these things are going to receive the UAP classification. They're not saying it's aliens. They're not blaming it on foreign nations or hostile entities or anything like that. They're going to, correctly so, leave these things in the holding bucket until they can eventually get sorted out. Or they'll live in the bucket until more information one day shines some light on the subject. And lastly, yeah. they're by the statement, they're also defining the borders of the mandate to their training ranges and their designated airspaces, where they do their practice runs and tests and of new equipment and these other things. So it's not civilian airspace that this is taking place in. And that's it. That's the whole thing. It's, generally speaking, I think a reasonable approach. Perhaps, though, what has people and the media making this a bigger news story, or maybe more accurately, a different news story, is the line in there about the nature and origins of UAP. I think there, in those creases, in the folding of those words, that sliver is where people can insert their preferred beliefs and use it as fuel to reinforce those beliefs. UFOs, extraterrestrials, alien spacecraft, they fit rather nicely into that tight space. Here's the kicker. If it were not for their pressure, their insistence, and their politicizing this, the task force likely would not have come about at all. But why is that? Well, it's due in large parts to the efforts by To the Stars Academy, an academy in name only, in my opinion. What they really are, and I've discussed them at least twice before on SGU, they call themselves a scientific body. I beg to differ. They're really UFO enthusiasts in the classic sense, with a newer, sleeker, modern packaging. That's basically what they are. And it's due to their efforts that this task force was eventually developed. Now, in some news articles, I've read about the UFO community's general response to this task force, and they're claiming it is a step in the right direction. They have cautious optimism that this would lead to maybe some more transparency concerning info and data collected by the armed forces regarding these instances. But to them, it really means a certain level of legitimacy to their cause. Now, I think, though, to the Pentagon's credit, they seem to have done a fair enough job in a couple of things. Following their orders from up high, because they were commanded to create this task force, and also a fair enough job in how they decided to couch this more correctly, I think, in the duty to protect our national security. Look, if a foreign country or organization is going to illegally access our military airspace, the Department of Defense has a duty to protect it, to protect itself, mm-hmm. protect the people from any potential threat. That's what they're tasked in doing. And the way they've worded this, they've kind of taken the fringe ideas, fringe elements involved behind the task force and brought it into something that's manageable, reasonable. All right, so be it. UFO skeptic Robert Schaefer, I'm not sure if we've actually spoken about Robert on the show before, but he does some good work.
Yes, we have.
Okay.
But it's been a long time, I think.
Yeah, it has. It's been a while. Robert Schaefer was quoted in one of the articles. He said, "I don't think this is as significant as some people are suggesting, the creation of the task force. It's just a response to all the publicity generated by To the Stars Academy leaking the three Navy infrared videos, which the Pentagon later released." And we've talked about those on the show before. We've, you know, analyzed them, Steve. I know you've talked about them. In which these videos, in which they can't identify, they can't clearly realize what it is. The instrumentation's unclear as far as what they recorded, but they appear to be distant jets, most likely, which probably were also outside of the MOA, military operations area. Again, you know, it's important to remember that they're only doing this in their cordoned off airspaces. This is not in civilian space. So those jets could have been far away outside of that space. The military is investigating out of an abundance of caution and a sensitivity to criticism. So all that's understandable. I think overall, one of the main takeaways about this is that they received pressure from a group of UFO enthusiasts, and this is their way sort of placating them, but in a way that doesn't make it a crazy spectacle or useless exercise. And they've just kind of brought it into their normal responsibilities and duties of being investigative and really trying to figure out what these things are under the blanket of national security, of which that is legitimate. But you also have to remember that whenever I see To the Stars Academy, you got to remember who these people are. And, you know, they absolutely believe, and they have no qualms telling people about what they believe.
Yeah, but the bottom line is, though, the Pentagon is going to be studying things that they detect on radar or that pilots see that they can't identify. So what? That's like they should be doing that, right? That should just be baked into the system. And they have with zero connection to aliens, you know, or space or right. or flying saucers.
Yeah, because they need to know what these things are.
Yeah, they also need to know how their radar misidentifies things or creates false positives. Yeah.
Limitations of the
pilots. How pilots misidentify things, optical illusions, et cetera. And so to better train, because a lot of these pilots are reporting birds and things like that, and they just need to know what they look like every possible way they could look under different conditions. Just strip the presumption of like flying saucers or aliens out, and it's perfectly reasonable.
Right.
Yep. And it comes back to those Department of Defense videos that, again, they released about four or five years ago, or that were recorded 4 to 5 years ago. And, you know, it still is generating action at even the highest levels of our government. Department of Defense is right in the center of it.
All right, Jay, it's Who's That Noisy time.
All right, guys, last week I played this noisy. So what is it? You guys have any guesses?
Well, it's a hammer and an anvil is what it sounds like to me, but they're creating, obviously, musical tones. That's what it sounds like to me.
Anybody else?
It just sounds like somebody working on their bike.
Musically.
Oh, my God. You guys paralleled so many emails I got. So the first person wrote in, this is John Mullen, and John writes, "Hi Jay, I think the sound of this week's Who's That Noisy is a train engineer hitting the coupling rods of a steam engine train with a big ass wrench." He says, "I hope I'm right, probably not. Keep up the good work, love the show. Can I get a shout out to my brother Kania?" Yes, it's spelled right, C-O-N-N, no, it's Conla, C-O-N-N-L-A, "who recently started listening and bought your book." And he, I guess he's turning into a skeptic. So guys, thanks for listening. Conla, I put it to you, man. Change the world, okay? It starts with the SGU. It ends with you changing everything for the better. Hurry up and get it done. Visto Tutti and Brendan Robinson both wrote in and said the same thing that Evan did. It sounds like a blacksmith or, you know, a hammer hitting an anvil. I think that is a good guess because you'll see why when I do the reveal, but it does sound like that. And another person wrote in, Juan Diagallo. He said, "Hi, Jay, no guesses here, but I figured out what Visto Tutti means, and I thought you'd be interested. It's Italian for, in quotes, seen all or something similar. Probably he means to say that he's seen everything." And I love that because I have like a 3D kind of thing here going on with Who's That Noisy. The people that write in are writing about each other now, which I find to be fascinating. But getting back to the anvil thing that you said, Evan, and a lot of people also wrote in, a listener named Vincent Lyon said, "Sounds like someone playing the anvil, right? Orchestras used to include an anvil, but now they use an instrument called the anvil. That is a series of hollow metal bars. Much easier to transport when the orchestra goes on the road. Only a handful of people still play the actual anvil." That's pretty cool. I got another listener here, Michael Cancellaro. "It's the percussionist for men at work tuning up before recording Land Down Under." Now, I know that song.
I love that song.
I'm a fan of that. I'm a fan of that song.
Yeah.
Oh, it's so good.
And I want to play it for you so you can hear. Oh. Listen, here's the song. Right?
Yeah, it does sound like the very beginning.
Yeah,
so it does.
Let me play the other thing.
Play the noisy again.
Here's the noisy. Totally, right? Very similar sound.
Okay.
Yeah. That's hilarious.
There is a similarity. I didn't connect the two, but it's not right, right?
Beep, beep, boom, boom, boom. Yeah, it's probably not right.
All right, so the winner for last week, Joe Vanden Enden.
How many Endens?
Vanden Enden.
Mr. Christian Fringensen.
Is he from the Netherlands?
I don't know. He did not say. He says here, if Kara asks where I'm from, don't tell her.
I think it's Vanden Enden, something like that. I think I interviewed somebody with that last name once.
So. It's funny, he wrote the answer in the subject of the email, which I didn't copy, but I put him in as the winner because he did guess that. He said, if I remember correctly, he said that they're the singing rocks, which it's actually, he's right, but they're the ringing rocks. A lot of people think that people are saying the singing rocks, but his guess was correct. He is the winner. So these are specifically, because these things exist in many places around the world, these are the ringing rocks park about 45 minutes north of Philly, and submit the following recording, which I did. You can hear him. This is Fred and Lynn, who sent it in. He's striking the adjacent rocks in the field.
Rocks.
He said there's thousands of boulders there. He had a ball peen hammer, and it's pretty cool, right? So what the physicality of this is that these rocks have a ton of iron in them. So they are considered rocks. They're not considered lumps of iron, but there's enough iron in them that the iron rings, right? So I guess the iron has veins of iron inside the rocks, and when you hit them, they ring and they make the noise. And you could find them at different notes because I guess it depends on the amount of, you know, the amount of iron and probably the density of the rock and all that stuff. So really cool. I've heard about these before. I never got to play them myself, but this I think maybe, Steve, I'm asking you because I know you know about this. Do you think that these are similar to when you hit the stalagmites?
That's what I guessed, if you recall.
You did last time we did this. You're right. That was a couple weeks ago, but I do remember you saying that, and I said to myself, holy shit, he was close.
Close.
That was good. So I thought this week was pretty cool because there was a lot of stuff going on here.
Mm-hmm.
I got a new noisy. The noisy was sent in by a listener named Dan A. And Dan sent in this sound. Check it out. Wow. So what is that? Be as specific as you can. And if you think you know the answer or if you heard something cool, please email me at WTN@theskepticsguide.org. Steve.
Mm. Yeah.
I've got nothing to announce this week, and I can't tell you how happy I am.
Really?
All right. Thanks, Jay. We're going to do a sort of a name that logical fallacy. As I said, this segment is really about just critical thinking in general. We've had a few emails about this, but asking us about the concept of doing your own research. And what does that mean? And is it legitimate? And can right. people do their own research? And so when someone says that they did their own research, they obviously don't mean they went into a lab and they replicated, you know, actual scientific research.
No, they like did internet research.
Yeah, they did. Yeah, they did. Yeah, internet research, or what, you know, we would charitably call literature research, right? So yeah. scientists do this. When scientists use this term, they'll say, you know, I researched the literature, you know, or it's background research or whatever. It doesn't mean you did.
You're right. Usually we just say I did a lit search. We don't really say research. You're right. We yeah. just search the literature, or we yeah, right, studied up right. on a topic.
Yeah, but it's basically the same thing. Because it's not experimental research. It's just literature research or a lit search. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I've heard it both ways. And so that's, which is perfectly legitimate. It just means you are researching a topic. So it does generate a little bit of confusion because the word research is used in multiple related ways. And it should be obvious from context what people mean. You know, I do think it's kind of snarky and not really constructive to deliberately confuse those meanings. Okay. You know what I mean? When someone says, I researched this topic, say, oh, did you go into a lab and publish your own research? Of course they don't mean that. They mean that they did a lit search, right? They did. They did background journalistic kind of research.
But it is such a sick burn when they actually did. Like, do you remember when Katie Mack very famously posted on Twitter, somebody was like, oh, you just a girl and blah, blah, how do you know? And her burn back was like,
was
well,
great.
Actually, yeah, it was yeah. like, yeah. I spent X number of years working on the theoretical blah, blah, blah.
Schooled.
Like, I went and got a PhD in it, so I'm not sure what else I could do at this point.
Right?
It's fine if you go the other way, if you say, I did actual research, like experimental research on it. But then, the second question is, what does that, is it legitimate? What does it mean when you do a literature research on a topic? But here's the thing, we all do it. That's what we all do. You know, it's perfectly legitimate right. to do that, right? That's what we do every week for the show. We do what we call a deep dive on a specific topic or on a news item, or we'll do background research on something, whatever. That's what science communicators, what journalists, what mm-hmm. authors, what you know, that's what we do.
Yeah,
journalists might go one step further and actually try to find the study author or the person and interview them. But
so that's investigative
right.
research. I agree. That's required. I
mean, yeah,
it is. That's called investigative journalism, and where they take that extra step.
Investigative is more intense than that. Like, most good journalists are going to speak to the study author, or they're going to speak to somebody in the field to get clarification and explanation. So
yeah.
that's beyond like what we do as SciCommerce usually. And then, yeah, then the deeper stuff is investigative journalism, where you're like
yeah,
putting a lot of time and effort into it.
Right,
but,
right. Although sometimes we do it as a quote-unquote interview, right? Where it's basically
sure.
we do it, we interview the researcher, but we just do it live on the podcast rather
yeah.
than just for a background for a written article. But yeah, so we do a mixture. We do very little investigative research just because this is, for most of us, this isn't our full-time job and we cover so much content. We're trying to translate what exists. So, but sometimes we do. We'll do investigations occasionally. You know, we'll do that. So, it could mean a lot of different things. And I do think it's just important just to clarify what you mean when you say research. You know, did you just do literature research? Did you do, you know, investigative research? Did you do any experimentation? Did you talk to people specifically? Did you, you know, try to uncover previously uncovered or unknown facts. You know what I mean?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's just, there's different depths or layers that you can get to. But 99% of the time when people talk about this casually online, they're talking about just online literature search.
And hopefully they did something like they clicked the links in the article and went a little deeper, or they cross-referenced it with the wiki article, or they said, I want to read about this topic from three different outlets to see if they presented the story differently. That's like a good way to do a deep dive on the internet.
Yeah, so exactly. But you're talking about doing it well, right? Which is now another layer here. So it's fine for people to quote unquote do their own research, mean look into a topic and see what's out there. The question is, are they doing it right? You know, are they doing it well? And are they appropriately evaluating the quality of their own literature, you know, online literature search, because you know, the problems don't come from people doing their own research. They come from people substituting their own research for actual experts. So what we know this as science communicators, what we are supposed to do is reflect the consensus of expert opinion on any topic, mm-hmm. not substitute our own opinion when it comes to what the science says, right? We may, you know, have commentary on the implications of it or whatever. And we cover it personally from a critical thinking and skeptical angle, which is a layer that we add on to the science stories. Like, what does this mean in terms of how people generate conspiracy theories or whatever? So, and I do think that we have legitimate expertise in that, right? In skeptical topics. Otherwise, like if I'm looking at, you know, whatever, pick any topic, like, but what anything we talked about tonight, you know, we're just looking at what's been published. What are the experts saying? What is the consensus of expert opinion? How do we put this into some kind of a scientific literacy context? And I think that's what people should in general be trying to do, find out what the consensus of expert opinion is. Are there disagreements? If so, you know, is it 99% 1% or is it really more balanced? You know, what percentage of people are saying this or that? Is this source an outlier source? Are they a biased source? Do they have a hidden agenda? Do they have an overt agenda? As you say, Kara, you need to do multiple, you always need to find out, are multiple different sources saying the same thing? Mm-hmm. Are they all copying the same source, or are they, you know, just really reliable? And be humble, you know, be humble about it. The problem comes from thinking because you spent some time on Google that you're now an expert and you can substitute your own opinion for the consensus of expert opinion, or that you think that you actually understand a topic. At the end of the day, the real question is, are you being humble? Are you being media savvy? Are you being, you know, scientifically literate? Are you appropriately listening to the experts? That's what you should be researching. What do the experts think? Thinking that you're going to be able to take a fifth grader's kind of science approach to a complicated topic and learn it well enough to substitute your own opinion for the worldwide community of dedicated experts. That leads you to Neil Adams territory, right? You weren't on the show at that time, but Neil Adams is a comic book artist who we interviewed on the show who thinks that the Earth is hollow and expanding, you know?
What an idiot. She goes, oh.
No, he's the poster child for, he basically did, Kara, he did this sort of internet quote-unquote research kind of stuff where he sort of reinvented the last 300 years of science all by himself, came to the conclusion that it was all wrong and that his artist's intuition, you know, showed him the truth where 300 years of scientists were led astray, you know. And yikes. he made like such basic mistakes, like fifth grade science class level, like you would have failed your fifth grade science class level with that kind of scientific mistake that you made. Like one of the key pieces of his argument was that heat rises. And I had to point out to him, like, no, it doesn't rise. There's no inherent tendency for heat to go up a gravitational
gradient.
Colder
sinks.
Yeah. Some fluids have so differential densities. Yeah. So some fluids, the cooler fluids will sink below relatively warmer fluids like air or water. within a certain temperature range. Then it flips, you know, depending on how
warm or cold you get. Like in your house, maybe.
But heat itself, the heat energy just radiates in all directions equally. It does not, quote unquote, rise. All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with three science news items or facts, two real and one fake, and then I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. We have a theme this week. The theme is hydrogen fuel. You guys ready?
Oh, God.
Ready for the hydrogen economy?
Well, I'm ready for the hydrogen economy.
Yeah. Are we ever ready for any of this? Ever? No.
All right, here we go. Item number one, the majority of hydrogen is produced by electrolysis from water and is as clean as the source of electricity used in this process. Item number two, the global production of hydrogen is more than 70 million metric tons annually, which could theoretically produce 2.3 billion megawatt hours of electricity. And to put this into perspective, U.S. energy production is 4.1 billion megawatt hours annually. So more than half, basically, of the America's energy use. All right, and now item number three, hydrogen is about 2.8 times as energy dense as gasoline by weight. Bob, go first.
Called it.
God, I haven't looked into hydrogen in this way in so long. I remember I was so excited by it like 20 years ago.
20 years ago.
It's element number one, Bob.
Wait. Bob, you got excited by hydrogen?
No, the idea of hydrogen, a hydrogen economy, hydrogen fuel. And
isn't 90% of the universe hydrogen?
Let's look at the first one. The majority of hydrogen is produced by electrolysis from water and is as clean as the source of electricity used in the process. I'm going to jump to three and say that's fiction. I don't believe that hydrogen has 2.8 times the energy density as gasoline by weight. I'm not even very confident about that, but that's just striking me weird. So I'll say that's fiction.
All right. Kara?
Electrolysis from water. That makes sense, maybe. How else do you make hydrogen?
Could mine Jupiter.
Yeah, right?
Head to the sun, pick up a batch.
Is as clean as the source of electricity used in this process. Wait, are you saying that hydrogen fuel is as clean as water?
No, it basically means like if the electricity you're getting to do the electrolysis comes from coal burning, well, then that's how clean it is. If it comes from
I see what you mean.
solar panels, well, then that's how clean it is. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's basically in and of itself, it's a completely clean fuel, but you still have to use energy. You have to put energy into the
electricity
system somewhere.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
Okay. Right. Global production of hydrogen is more than 70 million metric tons. I hate these things where there's just like huge numbers. Like I know.
That's why I put it into context.
Hey, these numbers, trust me, these numbers are tiny.
Compared to your news item. So 2.3 billion megawatt hours of electricity, 4.1 billion. So it's about half, right?
A little more than half, yeah.
Yeah, a little more than half. Okay. Global production of hydrogen is more than half of all of that. Seems hot. Oh, but global versus the U.S. But aren't we one of the biggest energy producers? So that seems like a lot of hydrogen production. Shit. But I don't know what else it's used for. You're not just saying for like fuel cell cars or whatever. You're just saying hydrogen production in general. So there's probably some nuclear stuff. I have no idea. And then hydrogen's about 2.8 times as energy dense as gasoline by weight. I think it is way more energy dense because you can put these tanks in that are supposed to serve you for a really long time. It's like under pressure. You're talking about hydrogen fuel, right? Being 2.8 times as energy dense.
Just hydrogen gas. The gas,
just hydrogen gas in general. Mm. Oh, because that's the question. Is hydrogen fuel hydrogen plus something? Boo. I don't know enough about this, so I'm going to go with Bob because I trust him.
Okay, Evan.
Trust me.
I'm tempted to join that camp as well. For all the reasons stated. All right, if you're going to take gasoline... All right, and then compare that to hydrogen. Oh my gosh, that's a lot of hydrogen. But 2.8 times. Where would you come up with the 0.8? That's interesting. Why wouldn't you just say 3 though? Which would mean that the majority of hydrogen produced by electrolysis from water
Electrolysis.
Yeah.
As clean as the source of electricity used in this process. Oh, gosh, that sounds so plausible. But how? Okay. Yeah. And then 70
really
million metric
that,
tons. I mean, yeah, sure. It either is or it isn't. Fine. I'll put my flag down with Bob and Kara, but the 2.8 number there might be a key as to why that could be science, but I'll say it's fiction.
Okay. And Jay.
All right. So going down from the top, the majority of hydrogen is produced by electrolysis.
Electrolysis.
I am not sure about that one. Let me just go to the next one.
None of us are sure about any production. Of these.
Yeah, what are you talking about? You sure about any of this?
No, but I mean, I have a little tickler on that one, ooh. So I just want to go through ooh. The other ones. So I think I have something to say about them. Let me see. 70 million metric tons annually. I mean, I have no reason to disbelieve that. I mean, what would it be? Would it be 7 million metric tons? 700 million metric tons? Just to like, you know, change orders of magnitude. 2.3 billion megawatts of wow. I would say yeah on that. And hydrogen, the third one here, hydrogen is about 2.8 times as energy. Now, Bob, you were saying like you don't think it's that dense. I was thinking it would be even a little bit more dense than that. I know gasoline is very energy rich, but hydrogen, man, it's the number one thing on the table of elements. I mean, it's yeah. hydrogen.
The reason you know it's number one.
So I think that possibly this first one here, I just have never heard of electrolysis being a method to create hydrogen in scale. I mean, I've heard that you can, you know, I know that you can do that. I just didn't think that you could scale that up and make it like, I bet you that there is some other way that we produce hydrogen that isn't this. That one's the fake.
Damn. All everything right. I know from watching The Martian or reading it. But that was the opposite. He was making water, right?
So you guys all agree on number two, so we'll start there. Uh-oh. The global production of hydrogen is more than 70 million metric tons annually, which could theoretically produce 2.3 billion megawatt hours of electricity. And by comparison, the U.S. energy production is 4.1 billion megawatt hours annually. You all think that one is science, and that one is science. All right, you guys are all good so far.
We guessed correctly.
So 1 kilogram of hydrogen can produce 33 kilowatt hours of electricity. 70 million metric tons is 70 billion kilograms, right? Because a metric ton is 1,000 kilograms, so 70 million thousand kilograms. 70 billion kilograms, that's 2.3 trillion kilowatt hours or 2.3 billion megawatt hours. So if I did that math correctly. And then that I just looked up what like how much energy production is does the U.S. do, just to give it something to compare it to, just so you guys could know the scale of it. So yeah, that's a lot of hydrogen that is being produced worldwide. Kara, you are correct. The vast majority of that is not used in hydrogen fuel cells. Mm. They are used in industry. This is industrial use. A lot of it apparently in the processing of iron, but for other things as well. So yeah, so most of that hydrogen is used in industry. Very little is used in vehicles or in fuel cells. But there are lots of fuel cells around the world. Fuel cells are actually mostly used as stationary units for backup power. It could be a very reliable form of backup power. Hmm. All right, let's go to number one. The majority of hydrogen is produced by electrolysis from water and is as clean as the source of electricity used in this process. Electrolysis, of course, is the splitting of water into hydrogen and oxygen. Jay, you think this one is the fiction. The rest of you think this one is science. Oh. And this one is the fiction.
Oh, good job, Jay. I knew it. I knew it.
Oh, it feels so good. Jay, it feels so good.
And Jay, you're exactly correct because the vast majority. So, Jay, tell me then, where does the vast majority of hydrogen come from if not from splitting water?
Hydrogen trees.
Yeah, I mean,
they mine Jupiter.
I know that we can get hydrogen from somehow. Something to do with gas production. Not
methane.
Not, like, I don't know if it's liquid gas.
Comes
I don't
from
know
methane.
If petroleum production.
Methane.
But there is some. No, because I remember when I was a kid. Listen, I'm dead serious. There was a cartoon where they showed a guy telling you, like, we put oil in here and we boil it. And at this level, we pull off this thing. And at this level, we pull off this thing. And I think I remember hydrogen was one of the things that comes off of.
you know, fuel production. And yeah. then the cool thing is, I remember at the very end, he said, "We and this is where we get butane to put into cigarette lighters." You know what I mean? Remember that cartoon? Yeah. So anyway, that's what I'm drawing from. I think it's from fuel production.
Yeah. So it's the method is steam methane reforming, and basically they're pulling that hydrogen off of methane. It also produces carbon monoxide and carbon dioxide in the process.
That's all right.
So yeah, most of it's hydrogen mostly is a fossil fuel right now.
Wow.
Which is a problem. It's a limitation on scaling it up, as you say, Jay. The goal would be to be able to make the majority of our hydrogen from electrolysis, you know, from water, because then you're splitting hydrogen into water into hydrogen and oxygen, and then when you burn it, you just recombine it, you know, and then which creates water as a byproduct. So it's sort of a closed cycle in terms of the material. And you're just using hydrogen as a way of storing energy, which is what it is, because there's negligible free hydrogen on the earth. So unless we start mining it from one of the gas giants, we have to get it.
Bob, which planet?
Strip it off of something else.
Jupiter, Saturn, whatever it takes.
But it's a very efficient way to store energy, though. It's actually more efficient than in many ways than batteries.
Really?
But the problem is we need a way to scale up a green and efficient way to produce hydrogen. For example, a lot of labs are researching the sort of artificial leaves, right? You guys have heard that.
Yes.
You basically use a solar panel of some sort to split the water. So the electricity is coming from the sun and you're not using fossil fuels. All this means that hydrogen is about 2.8 times as energy dense as gasoline by weight is science.
Wow.
So it's by weight. It's by weight. So it doesn't matter how compressed it is because it's, you know what I mean? The more you compress it, the heavier it is and the more energy you have. And it's just the hydrogen itself in terms of how much electricity you can extract out of it. How much energy can you get out of that kilogram of hydrogen in order to translate that into the rotation of your wheels of your car? You know,
right.
By weight, it's 2.8 times that of gasoline, which is really good because, you know, you want to keep the weight down. However, not by volume. So that's the key. By volume, it's hard. So it's less energy dense by volume. Of course, it depends on what the PSI is, but most tanks are going to be between 5,000 and 10,000 PSI. So 10,000 PSI is kind of at the high end.
Wow.
And, you know, do you really want to be driving around with a tank of hydrogen gas at 10,000 PSI?
Yeah,
probably not. So that's, you know, I think that's a limiting factor on hydrogen fuel cells for vehicles.
I've heard talk of making like a hydrogen slurry.
So this is, Bob, this is the talk for the last 20 years, as you said. This is 20 years ago, it's like all we have to do is figure out a way to bind up that hydrogen in a safe solid form or liquid form or whatever.
So
and that's what they've been working on for 20 years. There's lots of, you know, progress being made and lots of potential things, but nothing that has been able to be like the killer app that breaks through and suddenly makes hydrogen like a great fuel.
They'll start redesigning all vehicles. Our machines and things now based on hydrogen power.
Yeah, so right.
Too soon.
So, you know, there are still people predicting that hydrogen is going to be very competitive going forward. We have to sort out these problems. We have to figure out how to scale industrial scale electrolysis with clean energy. We have to infrastructure to distribute it. There's already a lot of hydrogen pipeline, but it's not like the infrastructure is not built around cars. You know, it's built around industry.
Right. But there are people who drive hydrogen fuel cell cars. It's not like it doesn't exist.
No, it exists. It exists. Yeah. You know, absolutely. But it's a tiny, tiny, tiny sliver of all vehicles. You know, I think there's like 40 commercial hydrogen stations in the United States. 40, 40. Yeah, that's not a lot. Though Connecticut has one, apparently. Oh. Most are in California. Almost all of them are in California because, you know, the governor, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger 20 years ago said, build it. You know, we're going to build the hydrogen superhighway and then they will come. But
we're going to pump you up with hydrogen. Yeah.
I also think our hydrogen incentives are higher, or at least the last time I looked for my incentives on my car, like hybrids were the lowest incentives and then with FEV, so full electric vehicles were higher, and the hydrogen was like at the top.
So hydrogen the thing is, you shouldn't just focus on vehicles because hydrogen may be a good energy source and it may find its niche, right? So like, for example, trains. You don't need to have a huge network of gas stations because, you know, you pretty much know where the trains are going to go, right, along the tracks. And so you could just build an infrastructure for hydrogen for trains. That would be a lot easier than building it for, you know, cars everywhere. Or, if, again, for stationary backup power, they're great. They're really, really good. So, again, it is a reasonably efficient way to store power, to store energy. And so as backup power, you know, it actually works really well. So we'll see. It'll be interesting to look ahead, you know, 20, 50 years and see, you know, what role hydrogen is playing in our energy infrastructure. But don't just focus narrowly on, like, driving cars, you know, because it's still in the realm of possibility. And I just think that battery technology has been on a steeper curve for the last 20 years than hydrogen. And it just, you know, and then there's the infrastructure question usually is the deal killer, right? Mm-hmm. You know, that's why gasoline beat out everything else 100 years ago. It was the infrastructure. It wasn't
there. And now
there
we have pretty decent electric car infrastructure and it's only getting better.
Right, right. Okay, good job, Jay. Sniff that one out.
Yeah.
I mean, I pulled a memory from my childhood and it worked.
It worked. All right, Evan, give us a quote.
I should have used more common sense, maybe. But this quote might tell me otherwise. This quote was offered by our listener, Russ, in Iowa. Thank you, Russ. But too often, common sense is the safe harbor of ignorance and an excuse for intellectual laziness. They don't need facts because they already know the truth. Their common sense has spared them the effort of investigation or thought. And that's from a book called Captiva. Fiction, written by Randy Wayne White. He's the author. He's written a ton of books. I went and looked at his list. He's not a skeptic per se or anything. It's just this particular passage was in one of his books, and Russ picked it out, and I thought it was good because we've actually talked about common sense before, and I know I had to sort of abandon the concept of starting with common sense with an idea as being kind of this sort of reasonable starting point in which you could go and then do some, you know, either further investigation or further expansion on any idea or subject. But common sense will much more often lead you astray than it will to any sort of good answers.
Probably also depends on where your common sense came from.
Absolutely.
You know,
so
we all have different
common sense. So subjective.
It's basically your biases, right? Your quote unquote common sense. It's confirmation bias more than anything else. All right. Thank you, Evan, and thank all of you for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thanks, Doctor.
Every week, brother.
Hydrogen.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.